Montana talks here. Live and local. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint. Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Yeah, speaking of the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association, great to have Mark Lambrecht with MECA kicking off the show for us here on this Wednesday morning. House Bill 490, I believe, was the number. You guys heard about that topic a lot. And many of you are probably electric cooperative members just like me. And so many of you probably contacted your lawmakers urging them to support House Bill 490. Well, the big news, not only did that bill pass the legislature, Governor Greg Gianforte has now signed it into law. Mark Lambrecht, great to have you back on the show.
Well, good morning, Aaron. Good morning, listeners. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, how pleased are you and your fellow electric cooperative folks that House Bill 490 has been signed into law? And then remind our listeners the importance and the significance of this legislation.
Yeah, we're very, very happy about this. This has been over 2 years in the making, a really heavy lift. And you know, the main purpose of this is to reduce fire risk in Montana. We can talk about the details of it, and also to prevent the California standard of strict liability from taking root here, which would have made it very difficult for utilities to provide electric service, which is their obligation into the future. So we were very, very pleased that the governor signed the bill yesterday.
Yeah, I know the biggest concern I had and many others had was, okay, we've seen what's happened in places like California. And the concern was like, okay, so let's say your electric cooperative or your electric utility, they do everything they can to mitigate a fire from breaking out, to mitigate the fire risk. But let's say somebody else blocks them. Let's say the federal government says, no, we're not going to let you cut those trees down. And then a fire breaks out. And then now you get sued or you get held accountable for something that wasn't even your fault. And then we potentially lose access to that power. It could potentially bankrupt an electric cooperative.
Mm-hmm. That's what happened in California. So California has a standard of inverse condemnation with strict liability in its state constitution. What that means in English is if there's a fire and the utility is involved, we go automatically from the fire to how much does the utility pay. And that required damages of over $1 billion for a California utility, ended up having to declare bankruptcy, lay off thousands of workers, and ironically, not make the investments that they had planned into fire mitigation. So that's one of the strongest points of the bill, is that it declares that strict liability cannot be applied in Montana. We knew it was coming here. They tried it in Oregon, some of the plaintiff's attorneys. But the most important part, we feel, is that it requires investor-owned utilities and electric cooperatives to develop and comply with wildfire mitigation plans. And that spells out everything from inspection, operation, procedures, maintenance, repair,
On down the list, yeah.
Vegetation, yeah.
Yeah, hold that thought, yeah, because that was kind of the next question, too, which is what is next? All right, stand by. Back to Mark Lambrecht right after this.
Montana Talks, uniting the Treasure State, one conversation at a time. Here's your host, Aaron Flint.
Yeah, last October, it was great. I was at the MECA annual meeting in Great Falls, and it just so happened to be that now Senator Tim Sheehy and Louisiana Senator John Kennedy, they were up at the airport. So they swung down to the co-ops meeting, and Sheehy jumped behind the microphone and explained exactly what the situation is here. Here's the deal. A fire breaks out. It's not the electric cooperative's fault, but then they get sued or they get punished over a fire that wasn't their fault. And then now his ranch in the Little Belts loses access to power. because of a fire that wasn't the fault of the co-op. That's what House Bill 490, signed into law by Governor Greg Gianforte, is basically designed to prevent from happening. Mark Lambrecht with Mecca, hit on some more of the high points of this legislation, and then also talk about what's next for these electric cooperatives and utilities working to implement this.
Of course, Aaron. And just before the break, I started talking about the wildfire mitigation plans a bit. And I just wanted to say that 17 of the 25 electric cooperatives operating in the state of Montana already have their plans developed, and the rest are busy working on them right now. Just some of the other high points on what's in there is a very serious protocol for managing vegetation to keep limbs and trees away from power lines and other infrastructure. But the public involvement is a really big part of this as well. Each co-op and utility has to consult with local, state, and federal, tribal authorities to make sure that there's coordination, and then also a very serious public review process and comment periods, things like that nature. But the difference here is that if a utility and a cooperative is in full compliance with its plan, they're not considered automatically liable, as opposed to strict liability in California. That doesn't mean that it can't be proven otherwise. It's just like, you know, other law in Montana, you're innocent and proven guilty. So if there is evidence that a utility was negligent or wasn't in substantial compliance with its plan, they can still be considered negligent. So that's really where this came down. But it helps ensure that utilities with an obligation to serve the public can continue to do so in the event of a wildfire. I wanted to take just a moment real quick here to thank some of the lawmakers and others who made this happen. Our sponsor was Representative Amy Regeer of Kalispell. She did a phenomenal job managing this bill through both houses of the legislature. Senator Vince Rickey carried it in the Senate. We had Senator Usher, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, did a great job helping us through there. Representative Bill Mercer helped make the bill better from a legal standpoint. We had strong support from Representative Greg Overstreet from Ravalli County, Representative Shane Clacken from Grass Range, Tyson Running Wolf from Browning, Tom France from Missoula, Senator Carl Glenn from Kalispell, and of course, Lieutenant Governor Juris was involved early on, helping us make sure that we hit all the marks from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, and you know, for those of us that are members of electric cooperatives, you know, we get to vote for our leadership. We get to take part in these types of decisions. So I'm assuming these wildfire mitigation plans, then, you know, hey, we the people get to take part in that process. But for the electric utilities, for the other ones like the Northwestern Energies of the world, et cetera, that will go through the Public Service Commission, the elected Public Service Commission, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the Public Service Commission, they will be allowed under the law to hire a technical master, meaning an expert in the field, to help them review the plans submitted by Northwestern Energy and MDU. That service will be paid for by those utilities, and the governing authority for co-ops, their elected boards of trustees, will do the same thing for the plans submitted by the electric cooperatives. And that's the next part of this is, toward the end of June, we have a meeting set up with all of the electric co-ops in Montana. We're bringing in an expert who has developed wildfire mitigation plans around the country, and he's going to be working with each co-op to make sure that their plans hit the mark on what's required by House Bill 490. Some of those that already had their plans will be making some changes, and of course, this will be helpful for those co-ops that are developing new ones. And this is very important because we've got a short time frame. Everything has to be in place and operational by the end of this calendar year. So we've really got to get after it, and it's going to benefit the public and all ratepayers and co-op members by having these in place, especially by the time we get into fire season.
That's right. And wildfire mitigation plans and electricity has already been a big, important conversation already. But look at the demand for electricity, massive demand growth projected for electricity. A couple of guests we're going to have coming up after you are going to talk about that very topic, data centers, AI, and so much more. So we got to plan not just for now, but for future growth.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the projection, to continue to have economic growth in Montana and demand for electricity. And as I mentioned before, we have an obligation to serve that demand, but we also have an obligation to keep costs under control for our members. And we can't do that if there's massive lawsuits that aren't warranted that have to be paid. And at least for electric cooperatives, those costs would be borne by our members. It's a direct pass off to them. So the other thing is, you know, our insurance costs keep rising. And that's one of the other things that drove our interest in this bill. Actually, you know, the insurance company for electric cooperatives really wanted us to be able to have solid wildfire mitigation plans, reduce the risk of fire, so they could continue to provide.
Also keep those insurance costs down. Yeah, that's another key part for everybody. All right, Mark Lambrecht with MECA. Great to have you on the show. Congrats on the legislative victory. Thanks for your time.
Securing America.
Authorities from multiple federal agencies announced the details of a record-setting drug bust Tuesday. The bust, which took place in early December, netted 1,500 kilograms of fentanyl, the largest on record. U.S. Attorney for Southern California, Adam Gordon.
That's more than 1.65 tons of fentanyl.
As a result, seven members of the Sinaloa cartel were charged not just with drug crimes, but as members of what the Trump administration has designated as a foreign terrorist organization. That includes a father and son who led this particular faction of the cartel. Homeland Security Special Agent in Charge, Sean Gibson.
They threaten our national security. With this new approach, we now have another powerful tool to help tear down the cartel's infrastructures.
Gordon also adding this warning.
To the leaders of the Sinaloa cartel, you are no longer the hunters. You are the hunted.
Kevin Uretsky, Fox News.
Did you?
Broadcasting live across the big sky. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Well, what a perfect tie-in to our next conversation here. Yeah, great to catch up with Mark Lambrecht with the Montana Electric Cooperatives Association. And one of these days, well, we'll have to talk with our friends from MECA about this very topic as well. AI and the future of electricity demand. Well, not even just the future, the right now of electricity demand. But yeah, last night I got to sit through an incredible presentation and incredible panel discussion as well. And it triggered this tweet. I posted this on X last night. Electricity. Enviros started demanding electric everything. Remember, they want, you know, California. Yeah, you got to have an electric lawnmower, not just electric cars. And then they wanted to shut off the electricity whenever they didn't have enough, right? They wanted electric lawnmowers. You had to have electric everything. They wanted you to get rid of your gas stoves. Got to be electric. And I like cooking eggs on a gas stove. It's just, there's something better about cooking eggs with a gas stove instead of an electric stove. Do you guys feel me on that one? But yeah, when it comes to electricity, environmentalists started demanding electric everything. They created this monster, and now it is hungry, real hungry. And I tweeted that out as I was listening to Paige Lambermont. She is a research fellow and an energy policy expert with CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And yeah, she's on the ground here in Montana, along with Kendall Cotton, the CEO of the Frontier Institute, with the Montana-based think tank, doing some great work. Kendall, Montana first, we'll start with you. Great event last night. Thanks for letting me take part.
Yeah, well, thanks for showing up, and thanks for having me in studio.
You gave a great legislative update, and I definitely want to touch on that as well. Everything from property taxes to housing costs and more. But big picture, I really felt that this CEI panel discussion that you had talking about energy, electricity, AI, data centers, that's a key part of addressing the whole property tax question, if you ask me.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the future we're talking about. I mean, this is what Montana's economy is going to be all about in 25 years. It's going to be demand for data. It's going to be these data-intensive businesses. We're going to need to talk about data centers and how to power them with hopefully with Montana-made energy.
Well, that's the thing, is you can build these data centers anywhere right now. Mm-hmm. And like I was talking with one friend who was at the event last night, and he's like, yeah, they've got data centers in Austin, Texas, but why would you build a data center in Austin, Texas? Property costs too much. You've got too many people there. You can build these things anywhere. Why not build it closer to the power source? It could be the natural gas coming out of our oil well sites in eastern Montana. It could be the natural gas deposits themselves. It could be coal. It could be small-scale nuclear. Any of the above, right?
That's exactly right. We actually have the best climate for data centers, too. I mean, you have all these computers operating, and they put off a lot of heat. So you need a cool climate. So Texas doesn't really make the most sense. Montana's the perfect place to build data centers, and it has a lot of benefits for Montana's economy, not just in, you know, the tech space, but, I mean, data centers, you know, what goes into data centers is computer chips. And computer chips need rare earth minerals that we have here in Montana. So we can mine the minerals, we can produce and refine it all here. We also have semiconductor manufacturing going on in places like Kalispell. We have photonics that goes into that, Basin Bozeman. All of our industries upstream of data centers can benefit by this growing demand. And then the energy production, they need massive amounts of energy to operate, to crunch all the numbers and the algorithms that go into data and computing. So we can power that with our reliable energy sources, oil and gas, coal. We have, you know, hydro. We have it. Hydro, exactly.
You could have a small hydro on your own private land, and you could be crypto mining. You could have a hydro, little hydro operation that could be generating power right there for cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. As a crypto mine, and you could bring in a little extra money to the ranch by doing something like that. And then the hydro power also helps back up that pond, so you got more water for your cows later on in the year, too. I mean, it's just crazy when you think about what all could be done right now. Well, let's welcome now Paige Lambermont, a research fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. So cool to hear you and your colleagues speak last night. Share the numbers again, because I don't know if I did I hear you right? I saw on your tweet here 19 gigawatts of new data center capacity is anticipated.
Yes.
That's what we're supposed to add. But meanwhile, we're losing a whole boatload of electricity over the next few years at the same time.
Yeah, it's a concurrent problem. So we're getting 19 gigawatts of new data center demand in the next 5 or so years. At the same time, by 2034, 79 gigawatts of thermal capacity, so nuclear, coal, natural gas, are scheduled to go offline.
What's that number again?
79 gigawatts.
79. I thought I heard that right. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of power. I mean, Plant Vogtle that went online in Georgia a few years ago, the huge new nuclear reactors, that's a 2-gigawatt facility. It took a decade to build.
So we're losing how many, 40 of those in the next,
40 Plant Vogtles.
We're losing 40 Plant Vogtles in the next how many years?
By 9 years, by 2034.
Wow. And then on top of that, we need, you know, set aside losing all of that power, we need to add about 10 of those.
Yeah, we need to add new capacity and keep existing capacity online. I mean, the power plant rule that EPA promulgated recently, or a few years ago, that's going to go into effect, would cause almost all coal plants and the majority of natural gas plants to go offline by the mid-2030s. It's not going to happen, I don't think, because just physical reality on the grid prohibits it. But right now the plan is that all of the coal plants shut down, and that most of the gas, anything that can't co-fire with hydrogen or do carbon capture, both of which are not very proven technologies, would have to close. There's just no way that given the demand on the grid right now, that's possible.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I remember when I was working on energy policy on Capitol Hill, about 25 years ago now, aging myself here, you know, we figured 1,000 megawatts was enough to power. What would 1,000 megawatts? So when you talk about 2 gigawatts, when you talk about the need for 19 additional gigawatts of electricity, and combine that with the fact that we're losing potentially 79 gigawatts if things keep moving forward the way they are, how do you break down a kilowatt, a megawatt, and a gigawatt for the everyday person?
A gigawatt is enough electricity for a few hundred thousand households. But industrial applications use way more. So maybe, you know, one big steel mill or or 300,000 households, depending on energy demands, somewhere in there. So pretty big amount of electricity. But electricity is the way that we do meaningful and important work. And as new technology arrives that needs more meaningful and important work to be done, it's going to demand more electricity. And so I think seeing new demand as a problem to be solved rather than one of the side effects of innovation and of advancement is it's the wrong idea to take, right? Like, this is a problem we need to solve to get the good, cool things to happen, but it shouldn't make us, like, decide to ban new data centers or prevent new things from happening. It's a problem we have to solve so that this thing that is happening can happen.
Yeah, because the fact is AI, artificial intelligence, whether you like it or not, it's like any technology. You know, there's going to be good that comes from it. It can be used for bad purposes as well. But the reality is, from a national security perspective, is we are in an AI arms race with the Russians. We are in an AI arms race with the Chinese. It ties into nuclear safety, nuclear security, nuclear technology. So put aside your smartphones and your Xboxes and whatever other electronic devices you have in your home for a moment. This is a national security issue. We're not stopping it. So how do we as Montanans capitalize on it? And how do we do this the smart way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the best way to capitalize on it is by building the power that's about to be demanded and by, you know, building data center capacity. One cool thing about this tech innovation is that a lot of technological innovations are limited on the tech side. This is limited on the power side. And so if you're ready to supply the power, the data centers will come. And that's incredible economic activity, right? That's jobs, that's other money. The technology companies that are building these data centers have money to spend on reliable power. They can build as much data capacity as the power will allow. So anywhere that's going to be able to provide them power and provide it quickly is going to reap incredible economic benefits.
Kendall Cotton with the Frontier Institute, you gave a great overview of the legislative session last night. You talk about a lot of the good things, too, that maybe aren't getting the attention because there were so many frustrating things about this legislative session. But when you talked about property taxes, I totally agree with you. There's no way that everybody could be happy with whatever property tax relief came out of the legislature or even could have come out of the legislature. Our property tax system, I think, is just a straight up mess. But I think we can all agree that part of the reason why our property tax picture is such a mess right now is because for decades now, they have been destroying our industrial base, especially in rural Montana, eastern Montana in particular, or in, you know, places like Libby, et cetera. And so, but to me, this is one way that we rebuild that industrial base, our power base in particular, with high-wage energy jobs and potentially a lot of revenue that could flow into these remote counties as well.
Yep, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, so a lot of people like to say that, well, Montana's becoming just kind of a tourist state, and we ought to just double down on that. You know, we should be one of the scenery states like Hawaii, for instance. And I completely disagree. I don't think that's the future for Montana. That's not a future Montana that I want to live in. I want to see a Montana that builds things like we used to do. You know, when we had the richest hill on earth in Butte, and we supplied all the copper that, you know, basically helped us win World War II. And we were talking earlier, it was like something like 30% of the world's copper came out of Butte. We need that kind of industrial capacity again here in Montana. And the way to do it is to promote innovation, to promote a light touch regulatory framework, so we're encouraging people to build things, and we're reducing taxes and the burden of government. Absolutely.
Speaking of data centers and Butte, I caught up with J.P. Gallagher, the Butte Silverbow chief executive. I was like mayor, county commissioner. It's a chief executive in Butte, but we actually talked about a big new data center that they're hoping will come to Butte. And that's like a billion-plus investment that they're talking about there. But again, where are we going to get the power from for something like right. that? And we've got a big, beautiful mine there to keep powering as well. Hold that thought. I'm actually going to go check the transcript. I've got this little AI software that I can use to read the transcript of that conversation with J.P. Gallagher. So I'll check that here during the break, and we'll come back to our conversation here with Kendall Cotton and Paige Lambermont with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We can take your phone calls as well if you want to jump in on the conversation.
This is where Montana talks at with Lane Nordlund.
Farmers could see an expanded safety net under a new package released by the House Agriculture Committee on Monday out in Washington, D.C. The bill set for debate this week boosts crop insurance, raises reference prices for major commodities under the price loss coverage program, and increases farm payment limits from $125,000 up to $155,000. The budget reconciliation package laid out by House Ag Chair G.T. Thompson covers major sections of the farm bill, from commodity, nutrition, trade, crop insurance, and research, while leaving out conservation, forestry, and rural development. Livestock producers would also benefit with 100% payments for losses to predators, 75% payments for weather-related losses, and compensation for unborn livestock deaths. But the bill is sparking controversy over deep cuts to nutrition assistance. It trims $290 billion from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, or SNAP, program over 10 years. Raises the age for work requirements from 54 to 64 for able-bodied adults without dependents, and shifts more SNAP costs to states. Supporters say the bill strengthens the ag safety net and brings more accountability to food aid, while critics argue it threatens food security for vulnerable groups like seniors and low-income families. A committee vote is expected soon. I'm Lynn Northlund.
Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right. Yeah, if you want to jump in on the conversation here with Kendall Cotton, the CEO of the Frontier Institute, and Paige Lambermont, a energy policy expert and research fellow with CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a great think tank if you haven't been following them over the years, especially when it comes to energy issues. Yeah, give us a call, 406-294-0970. Let me play real quickly here, or you can message us on the Montana Talks app as well. So, yeah, so I was talking with J.P. Gallagher, the chief executive for Butte Silverbow, and you know, I was talking with him about, you know, a number of other topics, but then I said, hey, what else is going on in Butte? You know, what else do you want to tell folks across Montana? And so he was talking about, so we got to talking about, you know, the demand for energy, the demand for electricity, you know, everything that we're talking about right now. And they've got a major data center that they're working to bring online in Butte Silverbow. Here is what J.P. Gallagher had to say.
We've had a purchase and agreement to purchase 600 acres out of the Montana Connections Industrial Park. And so we have interest in the data center here. We've been in a lot of conversations. And so that's moving forward. It's, you know, one of those things that, you know, it's a challenge. Where's the energy going to come from? But these data centers, just based on what we're doing right now, you know, I'm on my cell phone, the demand for AI, and it's here. It's a real thing. And so they're looking at us, and we're on board with locating this data center here in Butte. And so the energy things, they're going to have to figure that out. There's no doubt about that. But we're on board working with them. It's a huge investment into our community. They talked at $1 billion to $4 billion type of investment.
Wow. All right, there you go. $1 billion to $4 billion with a B type of investment. Paige, that's a huge deal for Montana, and especially Butte.
Yeah, I mean, that's a massive amount of money, and that's the amount of money that these projects generate. We're not talking small dollar figures here. We're talking power demand that generates data center wealth that, would go into the communities it's part of. You know, you're getting jobs for those facilities. You're getting jobs to build the facilities. And I think that shouldn't be underrated in the conversation.
Yeah, and Kendall Cotton, you know, that was about a 16-minute conversation that I had with J.P. Gallagher, but I wanted to go right to that part, so I had to use some AI software to pull up the transcript and get right where I needed to
awesome.
Go. So as we talk about AI and electricity, here I am using it in real time.
You know, we've made the case at Frontier Institute that Montana actually stands more to gain from compared to other states from AI disruption and integration with industry, because Montana's largest industry employment sectors by employment are low productivity, high skill, like healthcare, like education, even government. And it turns out that those are the types of industries that are most ripe for AI to come in and disrupt how things work, speed up, make everything more efficient, you know, helping doctors do, you know, diagnoses and assessments of patients and things like that. So I think that Montana, if we embrace this technology, we can really ramp up our economic growth and productivity. And that's important because if we are more productive, the people who live here are more productive, we can compete with all the people who are moving here from high productivity, you know, tech industries and things like that. We can actually compete against all the outsiders moving here.
Well, and your point earlier about tourism, you know, I always like to remind people, you know, when the tourism numbers were the strongest in eastern Montana, it's when we started rocking the bucket because, people make a lot of money here, but when they have jobs in like the natural resources industry, for example, and then, they also like to recreate here and tourism thing here. So if you have a dinosaur museum in eastern Montana or a state park, those people will go visit those places and your tourism numbers do better too. So it's not an either or type of a conversation. It's more of the above.
Right? Yep. Exactly. And, you know, you made the point earlier about, you know, this whole conversation about AI and energy and data centers and data is also implicating national security. And look, like at the turn of the century in like the late 90s, China was very famous. I mean, they basically identified key industries that they anticipated were going to lead the future and said that we have got to position China as basically a corner on those markets. And they've done that. But I think that we in Montana, in America, we need to start doing the same thing. And I think that with AI, with this data wealth, as Paige mentioned, and energy, we need to think about how do we get that domestic supply chain built in Montana to power this economy of the future.
I definitely want to get Paige's take on small-scale nuclear reactors because that's a totally new ball game as well. And I know they're talking about that for Colstrip. I mean, you want to help him meet this 19-gigawatt increase and the 79-gigawatt loss? Well, let's turn Colstrip 1 and 2 right back on, and let's talk about some of these other things. First, let's sneak some phone calls in here. Let's see. Let's go first to Will. Will in northwestern Montana. Will, did you have a quick question or comment? Thanks for the call.
Yeah, appreciate it. I'm concerned about Montana in terms of there was a reference to the Copper Kings and Butte ran this morning. So my concern is if the needs of Montana energy consumption your endorsement to AI, would that require my children to participate as they did in Butte?
All right. Well, thanks for the question. So, Kendall, I mean, I guess the way I see it is like, look, when you look at the environmental negatives from over 100 years ago, it's a totally different ballgame now. We know how to do this stuff now. Mining is a totally different ballgame. Timber production is a totally different ballgame. Energy production is a totally different ballgame, which kind of ties in with this nuclear question soon here as well.
That's right. I'll make a couple
Will,
points.
Thanks for the call. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Will. And I'll make a couple points in response. I think, number one, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, mining's a totally different ballgame than it was back at the turn of the century, and we do it a lot more environmentally friendly now, and we do it in a way that's way less impactful to the landscape. And we have a choice to make. I mean, we can either let all of this mining and energy development happen in China, where they have no rules, and it's absolutely destroying their environment. And it's, you know, if you buy into the whole contributing to global climate change and all that, I mean, you should be concerned about that. Or we produce it here, and we do it right. We do it in an environmentally friendly way that benefits America. I think that's
And by the way, we can do it in the less crowded areas. I mean, like if you drive across northeastern Montana, you could drive past a natural gas well and not even know. You might think it's like a little calving shed. You wouldn't even know that that was a natural gas well there right now. Well, you could have a small-scale crypto miner data center, and you might not even know what that is either, and yet it could bring in wealth and revenue for these counties.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's sneak in another caller here. Jason and Polson, did you have a quick question or comment?
I had a comment. I do support the harvest of the natural resources 100%. I grew up, you know, with logging and you know, not a lot of mining in the Colson area, but the timber industry is one of our most valuable. But the concern I have with the data centers, you know, is with every positive, there's always a negative. And unfortunately, the AI, and it's just going to increase the surveillance state that we already live under. You know, we can't hardly do anything without Uncle Sam knowing about it. And it's only going to, these AI data centers are only going to make that worse.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my biggest concern, is that with every, you know, with COVID, it was like you give up your safety for liberty, then you don't deserve it.
Yeah, great point. Great. That's a big concern. Paige, we talk about any tool can be used for good or for bad. That's why a lot of these safeguards need to be in place, especially. I mean, you guys are a libertarian-leaning think tank. You know?
I think that it's a totally valid concern, but that it's not the government that is building these data centers or utilizing these data centers. It's people. And things can always go wrong when people use new technologies, but I don't think that trying to stop people from using the new technology is going to solve that problem, right? Once the technology exists, so people are going to be using it, and I mean, individual situations are going to crop up that might require individual solutions, but I don't think that ahead of time preemptive bans on anything or preemptive government action is going to solve that.
Mm-hmm. It's coming. Do we profit off it or not?
Yeah.
As a state, or are we dependent on other states for
this? Is an area too where states can lead. I mean, so Montana, a couple years ago, we passed a constitutional amendment that said that in order to get digital information or your digital data, the government has to get a warrant. We added that to Montana's constitution, and that was an effort that we spearheaded. But that's a great example of, you know, the states need to step up here and put the brakes on the government. I definitely agree with that.
And Daniel Zolnikoff, State Senator Daniel Zolnikoff, was there last night. He's really been a driver of a lot of these first in the nation privacy protections. He also was the author of this Right to Compute Act, and that's another first in the nation led by Montana, right?
That's exactly right. And so the whole premise is we need to have the maximum amount of freedom possible for people, private people, to use this in a good way and to put constraints around how the government works with this technology.
All right. Let's see. We got a couple more questions inbound. We'll get to Lee in Kalispell on the phone lines right after this. He's got a quick question as well. So stand by. More with Kendall Cotton from the Frontier Institute and Paige Lambermont from CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, right after this.
Radio.
Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All this talk about power, before I get to Lee in Kalispell's phone call, let me tell you about power. Power Plus Pain Aid. I got to meet a Big Fork, Montana Marine Corps veteran back in Washington, D.C. during Trump's inauguration, and he's a fellow veteran. He said, Aaron, I got to send you some of my product here. It's an energy drink with pain-relieving vitamins in it, and it doesn't have all those chemicals that some of those other little energy drinks have. And so I'm a big fan of this product, big fan of stuff that's made in America, big fan of products developed by our fellow veterans that live right here in Montana. Here's the deal. If you want to try this product out, you can get 15% off your order right now. Go to drinkpowerplus.com, and you'll get 15% off when you use the code FLINT15, FLINT15 at checkout. So, yeah, you know, we always talk about, well, you know, no pain, no gain. Well, you can get more gain, less pain with Power Plus Pain Aid. Go to drinkpowerplus.com. Lee in Kalispell, did you have a quick question or comment? Thanks for the call.
Yeah, so this deals with natural forests and the power lines going through there. How about trying to mitigate the chance of fires by reducing the amount of trees you have around the power lines and power poles, say about 10,000 feet back on both sides? I'm not saying cut them all down. I'm just saying
expand the buffer zone. Yeah, no, great point. Because, Paige, isn't that exactly what California blocked the power companies from doing?
I mean, an important part of building out new power infrastructure or even maintaining what you already have is good forest management. And in California especially, they have really struggled to allow good forest management. A lot of environmental regulations have actually prevented, including things like NEPA, have prevented doing forest management the time that it's needed. And so then, instead of cutting back some trees, they all burn down. Which, of course, it protects the trees, right? By not allowing you to cut a few down, you're going to end up burning the whole forest.
And regulations are also a big barrier, too, like those transmission line upgrades, too. So you'd want to talk about if we want to bury the cable instead of having the wires going through, it would be a little bit safer, you know, less likely to start a fire. That requires some environmental analysis, and then you're opening yourself up to a lawsuit about endangering an owl or you name it, you know. And we've got to fix that problem.
California, they're trying to bury the power lines there? Because it would be cool if you could build all this power but bury the power lines, much like we bury the internet, fiber, right? They're trying to do it in this California town. They say that under the current regulations and the current everything, bureaucratic whatever, it would take 500 years to bury the power lines for one town, let alone a state the size of Montana that's like driving from Chicago to D.C.
500 years for a project that should take less than five?
Exactly. Yeah.
That is obscene. I think so much of the push now for the increasing power demand, I think, is really revealing the insanity of a lot of our power policies, right? Because when power demand over the last 20 years was fluctuating by between 2% a year, 1% a year, sometimes it was going down 1 or 2% a year, it wasn't doing anything. And so you could get away with doing a lot of kind of silly things that don't help anything. Now that we need more power, you can't get away with that anymore.
And now Google is going nuclear, Intel is going nuclear. It goes back to that, you know, they created the monster, and now that monster is really hungry. They don't care where they get their power from, and these are the same people who were lecturing us about electricity and all this nonsense just 2-3 years ago.
That is actually making me sort of hopeful. I think a lot of people, especially like in the tech industry, places like that, whatever policy for energy allows them to get what they need while still upholding the values that they think they hold works. But if you create a system for them where they can get the power that they need and not feel guilty about it, that's the best. It's, you need this power, and you're not going to get it from just wind and solar alone. That's not going to happen. So what can we do to make it so that you get this power efficiently and the whole system works? It's like, I think
EV thing blew up in their face.
It's revealed to a lot of people, I think, the problems with their energy policy ideas and their, you know, corporate commitments to things. They're realizing that, you know, we maybe can't be net zero by whatever year for internally within this company. Instead, we're going to prioritize keeping the lights on.
Yeah.
And I think that's been a good shift.
Yeah. John in the Flathead. John, did you have a quick question or comment? We're just about out of time.
Well, the quick question is anybody looked at the actual surge process when, let's say, the grid goes down, and then it comes back up online, and then that surge going through any new development or data centers, or how that actually works, because that's a big...
Yeah, basically, this is grid reliability, which is already questionable, right?
Yeah, so I think that he's talking about, like, a black start. So essentially, once the power grid goes down, if all of the power plants that were online have shut down, in order to get the grid back online and back to the 50 hertz frequency that it needs to function at, you have to do, like, a black start. It takes forever. It's hard. It's hard on all the equipment, and you're out without power for a while in the process. So making sure that we don't let the power fully go out, like a full blackout across the grid, not just like a regional blackout or brownout, but like an actual power outage.
EMP type of craziness.
Hard on equipment and keeps power off for a while.
Kendall Cotton, I know you've got a ton of great information and resources on your Frontier Institute website. Great to have both of you here. What else do you want to tell folks with about 20 seconds to go?
15. Hey, I would just say if you want to keep up with our work, go sign up for our weekly newsletter, Frontier Weekly. It's on our website, frontierinstitute.org.
All right, great to see both of you. Thanks for joining us here in studio. Appreciate it.
Thank you.